NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Flight Safety Detectives. I am Miles O'Brien, today joined by Todd Curtis and John Golia, both of whom have a lot of experience looking at aviation incidents, and most importantly for all of us, what lessons can be learned from them. We're going to talk today about an incident that occurred in 2022, March of 2022, in Oklahoma. This involved a twin-engine Comanche, 1967 vintage. Comanche was flown by a pilot who had mid-200-hour experience and not an instrument rating. He was, his destination, remind me the destination, Todd, where was he headed?
They were heading north to, I believe it was Nebraska.
North to Nebraska. And on the nose of that Comanche was a fairly significant, as you often see in Oklahoma, activity of storms, convective activity. What happened next is a scenario which points out a lot of, perhaps hubris, perhaps stupidity, and a bit of arrogance about or disrespect of what can happen in aviation. Again, we have a pilot here who is not instrument rated, flying into instrument conditions, initially at 9,000 feet, but perhaps to try to get over the tops of the weather as it became bad, getting into the 16,000 foot realm without oxygen, which of course is a violation of the rules. Above 12,000 feet, you're supposed to be on oxygen. Hypoxia is a subject we could spend a lot of time talking about and its insidious effects. And surprise, surprise, evidently spatial disorientation ensues and the aircraft falls to the ground, breaking up as it makes its way down. So, gentlemen, a lot of things that the pilot ignored and about common sense and even perhaps just basic rules of flying. Todd, what's your first take on this? What, if you had to pick of the series of mistakes we saw here, what would be the biggest one?
I think it was lack of foresight on the part of the pilot for several reasons. First, this person had an aircraft, a twin Comanche, very capable aircraft, that had the capability of having an oxygen system with all the various tools for that installed. And in this aircraft, and this is something that was said in the public docket by the instructor. The instructor said that, hey, he's only seen them use this system once in the aircraft, and they typically don't keep the tubing that you need to have this work in the aircraft. And again, the accident report, they said none of that tubing was there. So although there was an oxygen system there, there's no way it could be used. And second, this is a person who was apparently successful in business, had a twin-engine aircraft, got his private rating, and his instructor tried to get him to do instrument training for the basic reason. Even if you're not planning on doing instrument flight rules, there are very, very critical things that you learn doing that that can get you out of a tight situation like this. Specifically in this case, He flew into a situation where he had no visual cues with the ground because he was in weather that was above and below him. And as the NTSB pointed out, spatial disorientation in a situation like this is a very real possibility.
So, John, let's add one more thing to the mix here, which is we run into this quite a bit when we talk about these accidents. The term we like to use is get-there-itis. You talk about a dangerous phenomenon. Pilots, get something fixed in their brain. They are people who tend to set goals for themselves and try to meet them generally. And so if the destination is what you're after, you're going to do everything you can to make it. It's really a big problem in aviation, isn't it?
It's in every piece of aviation. We have it in pilots with wanting to get there. We have it in mechanics. Get it done-itis. We have it in people that load commercial airplanes. They also have get it done-itis. I mean, it's the accomplishing the job becomes the number one goal, and we get blinders on and disregard all the cues from all the other areas that should be telling us, you're going down the wrong path. And my first inclination when I looked at the details of this accident is what I preach: pre-planning. The weather, here, there, and everywhere in between. The weather should have been high on his radar. He should have known Oklahoma. I mean, before we had this show, the three of us were talking about the weather in Oklahoma. It's always changing. It's always known for being unpredictable and oftentimes very bad. So, I mean, that should have been very high on his in his mind, that he should have been keeping an eye on the weather and the track overlaid the weather that Todd pulled up. I mean, he was flying right into a major storm. He had ample opportunity to turn away from that, a half hour earlier.
Right? Yeah, he could
see it in front of him.
Yep. He could have clearly diverted. I cannot tell you how many times flying my Cirrus, particularly in Florida, you try to fly down across the Florida Peninsula on a summer afternoon, and that is a crapshoot. And oftentimes I would be met with a wall of, orange and purple. I cannot tell you how many times I just landed and sat, got a cup of coffee and waited for it all to pass. It's just insanity to fly a light aircraft into a cell like that. And pilots who do that are just not paying attention to the basics of aviation, structural dynamics, and human psychology. Todd, the other thing he could have done is just never launch the mission in the first place. My theory always was, because when you're doing a long flight and you see a line of thunderstorms, I always say fly up to the edge of the storms, because by that time things can break up, dissipate. You might be able to fly your way through with something like XM radio. You can navigate it, a little help from controllers. But maybe he should have flown and made a decision before he left that if I get to that storm and it's too big to divert, put it down and get a cup of coffee. What's the big deal?
And if you see from the pictures we have on the video version of this, there is a recreation by the authorities of what this storm looked like. They have a picture of it from above where you can see in the light gray areas, the lighter precipitation. And, from the side, the greener areas are the thicker precipitation. Looking at the full description of the weather, they were talking about, at the altitude he was flying toward the end of the flight, this was an area where there's also potential for icing and turbulence. So you already have a lot of risk piling up on top of one another. You have a VFR pilot in IMC. You have potential turbulence, potential icing, and the potential for hypoxia. As you can see from another graphic, which is from the ADS-B data that was on one of the tracking sites, he was flying this plane at about 9,000 feet for quite some time, about 45 minutes or so. In the last 10 minutes of the flight, he was actually above 15,000 feet. And without quoting the regulations chapter and verse, if you're above 15,000, everybody on board the aircraft has to have supplemental oxygen. And I'll say again, there was a oxygen system on the airplane, but the tools to use it, for people to use that system, were not present on the airplane. So it calls into question the decision-making. The pilot knows he can't use the oxygen system. Attempted to climb above 9,000, well above 12,500, which is usually the the trigger for, hey, you can stay here without oxygen between 12,005 and 14,000 for 30 minutes or less, and kept going above 15,000. So these were obvious things which, if he were thinking, would say, look, it's not worth it. Let's just do a 180 and turn around. But wait, this person did not have an instrument rating. I don't know from looking at his logbook if he had formal instrument training, but he didn't have a rating. But if he had that rating, he would have very likely had enough experience to know how to keep the airplane stable, how to turn the aircraft around, get out of the weather.
Well, anybody who thinks they can, in a small aircraft like that, overtop a CB like that in Oklahoma, you're going to be in serious turbulence, inability to maintain horizon. If you're not relying on your instruments, you're in enough trouble.
For those of you who are not from the Southwest U.S., three things you have to know about this weather situation. Oklahoma, early spring, Tornado Alley. Done.
It's the real deal. So, you know, John, turning around would have been a better option. Not launching probably would have been a better option. When we look at the system, it's quite possible, is by the way, at that altitude, he was flying at 9,000. That's an IFR assigned altitude. He might have been pawning himself off to air traffic control as an instrument rated pilot. It's not like they check your certificate when you file the flight plan. So, what can the system do to try to catch individuals like that and give them the Dutch uncle before they kill themselves?
Sometimes the controllers will rise to the occasion and turn the pilots in for altitude busting or problems that they foresee. But nobody really wants to be the snitch, so to speak, in that scenario. Right. And we don't even know how much communications this guy had with the tower. It's absent from the report. And did he ask the controllers what the weather was like in front of him? You know, and we've had people that the controllers didn't do a very good job of and sent little airplanes into category 5 thunderstorms like
Crossfield. Let's take a Scott Crossfield for a moment, right?
We did a show on that a while back, and I'll flash a graphic of the title card for that show.
The controllers are there to help you, but they're really not going to be your mentor and guide you through all of this. You ask for some help, they'll do it. If you get lucky and get a controller that's a pilot, he may give you some additional information, but they don't want to be drawn into your accident either, you know, because in the United States, after every accident, there's lawsuits fly around like crazy. And if a controller has gone outside of the realm of what the government says that he should be doing, now he gets some potential for personal liability in somebody else's accident. So, you know, they're careful in what they say and do.
Well, it's been well documented, particularly post-COVID, how overworked and stressed out these controllers are. They're not getting enough sleep. They're working these long shifts, and it really doesn't matter, because it's always in this country, it's always about the pilot in command. It is responsibility for this rests in the cockpit. Yes, it would be better if air traffic control would be a little more of a weather nanny for all of us. But these days with the technology we have, we should be able to see that towering cumulus nimbus cloud ahead of us and avoid it at all costs. You know, I remember very early on when I first got my Cirrus, and I was asking a controller once for a diversion several miles downstream. And I said, I think I need about 10 or 15 degrees left. And he said, well, I can't see any of what you're seeing on my screen here that you can see. In other words, I had more technology in the cockpit. That's improved. There's more weather overlays on the radar positions for the FAA today, but it's not their job to make you make a common sense, wise pilot in command responsibility decision. The system is set up to squarely put that responsibility in the left seat of the airplane.
I agree, because the way the system is set up in the U.S., it's up to the individual parts that are involved to do the right thing. like you were saying before. Maybe he filed a IFR flight plan pretending to be an IFR rated pilot. There's nothing preventing you from doing that. In fact, a lot of the system is automated. You can file a flight plan, an IFR flight plan, without talking to a human being. And the first time you talk to a human being is when you ask for the controller for the IFR clearance that you file. And as far as who's checking up on your, whether or not you're up to snuff when it comes to your recency and currency, well, that's up to you and your flight instructor or the people you're working with, in that you can be in violation of the regulations for months or years. And you don't have a system where the FAA is constantly, going through your books, like, and the IRS going through your accounting books. Well, how many hours have you had in the last X number of months? Are you within, this particular regulation? If you don't take the effort to at least be legal, that is following the regulations, no one else is going to make it.
So, John, one of the things I think about, and this might be a good place to end our conversation today, is what can be done from ab initio all the way down the line to ensure that designated, flight instructors, give people a sense of humility about what they're going into and sort of teach them about risk management holistically, the big picture here. I feel like that gets a little bit missed. We learn about procedure turns and we learn how to intercept the localizer. We learn, we learn the basics and the mechanics of flying, but I don't know that there's enough conversation about real world decision making and going through your own personal checklist about what's too risky and what's not. And I can tell you there, I had several times getting in that Cirrus list one day, and there were several times I would close up the plane and go over to Delta Airlines if I didn't feel comfortable. And if you don't apply that kind of rigorous personal and objective approach to it, you're going to get in trouble. But how can we teach that better, John?
Well, both Todd and I and Greg are members of the Trade Association for Pilots, instructor pilots. And I've sat through many of their sessions at Oshkosh and had many discussions with the flight instructors that were there about this very subject. It's ethics. It's the individual doing everything that he's been taught to do before he goes flying. And it's sometimes they don't have checklists. We go by memory way too often in the general aviation community. You can buy commercial checklists, but they're really not as thorough as I would like to see them. And, it's up to the individual, as you said. In Part 91, it's all about the individual. Your airplane, you need to fly it, keep it within the regulations. And that decision-making, aeronautical decision-making, it's got reams and reams of books written on it. And it's in the FAA, has a special book within the FAA, talks about it. The information is out there. It's just not being received and acted on. And that's part of the reason why we do these programs, is put it fresher in the memory of everybody. Get it into their heads so they can hear it, repeat it over and over and over again. You think I enjoy, at the end of every session, going through that same spiel with pre-planning and pre-flight your airplane? I only do it because I've seen so many bad examples of both the pre-flight and the pre-flights that I just need to keep them going. I don't want to see our people crash. And I said our people on purpose. I'm an aviation person my whole life. You guys are as well. We don't want to see our peers injure themselves. And I feel like, and I've had this conversation with Captain Sullenberg, right? Feeling like a preacher, because he does as well. Going out there trying to spread the word to people. Sometimes you see the light bulb go on, but most of the time they just look at you and go away. I mean, how do we pound that into people's heads? Society has been trying to do that since the beginning of time, I think. Just some of it is received and some of it just like water on a smooth surface just glides away.
And I think that takes final thoughts, Todd.
Well, I was about to say, this is a perfect segue into my second to last word. And this time I'm going to focus on the probable cause and findings, which is The National Transportation Safety Board determines the probable causes of this accident to be the pilot's loss of control of the airplane, resulting in an in-flight breakup. Now, for the video version of this, I'm showing a video from the public docket that shows the last moments of flight of this aircraft, and clearly the tail breaks off before the end. That's not the story here. Not even half of the story. And if you're using these reports to educate yourself on how to do better, go deeper than the probable cause. Go deeper than what's even in the report. If you have a public docket with more information, like what his instructor was telling him not to do early in his career, you'll learn something. It is a person who the instructor said, hey, you should have instrument training. He was too busy with his business. And he got himself into a situation where even some instrument training might have saved his life, but he didn't give himself that opportunity.
Good last words, gentlemen. I'll add one thing to it all. You know, John talks about checklists. Start your checklist when your alarm rings in the morning. How are you feeling? Did you sleep well? Are you stressed out? Did you have too many drinks too late last night? Just make a personal checklist for your own personal ability to fly. And as you get closer and closer to the airplane plane, formalize your decision-making process with an actual checklist that you've gone through even before you get to the aircraft. You'll be a much safer pilot. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you on the next edition of Flight Safety Detectives.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.